Okay, I hope everyone can hear me all right. Thanks all for coming. So I, as a forester research analyst, study application lifecycle management and related issues full-time. It's a real privilege to be able to do that. As an analyst, I'm obliged to wear a tie. I'm very easy to find in the conference if later you have questions, because that's what I do for a living, actually, is to answer a lot of questions for our clients, and also to write about the vendors in this space. So if there are vendors in the audience, let me just assure you, we love you all. And if you are really wondering, you know, we love one of you a little bit more. And if you're wondering if that's you, you're right. That's you. So no worries. All right. Dave West, my colleague, was originally supposed to be speaking here today. He and I are both the authors of the Application Lifecycle Management Wave and research into Agile and other things. So he apologizes for not being here. You got me. I'm in the Seattle area, and my family says that I talk a little bit like Fraser Crane, so I guess it's appropriate, and I've got the tie, so. And what I'm going to be talking about is management of software development, and that's the real emphasis of the talk today, is what have we learned about the efforts to apply business management to software development, really kind of the heart of what ALM is. And the lessons we've learned have been, you know, somewhat heartening, somewhat disheartening. We certainly had an approach that we tried for a good long time. It was a very predictable, understandable approach, which I'll describe in a moment here, but it wasn't a total success. There is a good news part of this, and that is that after some of those failures, we have been able to apply the lessons learned. And there's a nice coincidence in time with some newer developments in how we develop and deliver software that are making it possible to do ALM much better. So a good part of the talk today will be about those developments in the software world and exactly what they mean for an ALM strategy that you may be pursuing. But before we can get into those specific developments, I wanted to talk a bit about what makes application lifecycle management an urgent issue. It's not something that organizations that we talk to on a daily basis are putting on the back burner. It's why, you know, in my job, I'm answering, you know, questions every day about ALM. And, you know, it kind of starts with the evolution of software development. I'll give you a very brief history. And it starts with what is probably the most rhetorical slide you will see today. The pace of work is increasing. Clearly, I mean, that we're all very busy people. The demand for the software that we produce is very high. Nothing seems to be slowing down. You know, even if some part of the technology stack may mature, that doesn't mean that we live in such a mature technology world that it slows down the way that technological maturation often slows things down. In fact, quite the opposite. And at Forrester Research, our explanation for that is really that we've gone from what we call the information technology age into the business technology age. And we've, you know, this increased pace is kind of saying that we are the victims of our own success, that information technology was once something that a group of people dropped in the laps of business users. You know, here's this big application. Here's this big chunk of technology. It's up to you to figure out really what to make good business use of that. And people did figure it out eventually, and in so doing, they created new business opportunities. CRM, ERP, some of the classic applications that people deployed first were systems that did create opportunity. Opportunity was therefore a stimulus for people to come up with new technological inventions, which in turn created more opportunities, which in turn created more inventions. And this cycle has not only become more rapid, as you'll see in this diagram here over time, but also so closely intertwined, so much that we, you know, that it's hard to distinguish one from the other, that's what we mean by business technology. That it is, you know, this very rapid pace of business change and technology change tied to one another, so much so that these are systems now that we depend on. If our email goes down for an hour, We feel like our business has been crippled. If our email goes down for a day, it seems like a disaster, and we should all go home and wait for the apocalypse. And that's just one system of many that we're dependent on a daily basis. And also, another measure of how quickly things have changed. It's kind of hard to call 10 years the long view. 10 years doesn't seem, from a lifetime's perspective, like all that long. But from an industry perspective, it means that the marquee companies that we talk about today, a lot of the signature technologies like mobile devices that we see today, either didn't exist 10 years ago, or they existed in such a small form as to be almost indistinguishable from what exists today. So this is how rapid change is if you look at, this is one of many barometers of the pace of change. Another barometer is that the platforms are changing very rapidly. Today, the mobile device, the phone in my pocket, the tablet device sitting in my lap on the plane, those are quickly displacing traditional laptops in the way that laptops once displaced desktop machines, and desktop machines displace bigger machines. So we're seeing now that people are moving rapidly to this platform, not just as users but also as software professionals. And they're doing it in a way that's very multi-platform from the technology producer side. What this slide shows, just in summary, is that if you look at what sort of platforms people are supporting, the norm is to support multiple. It's not the case that you can say, look, we got limited resources, limited time, we're going to declare iOS the winner, we're not going to worry about Android or anything else, that's it for us. That's not the case, because really, we as technologists are being pulled where our customers are. And if our customers are on these multiple platforms, despite the inadequacy of the testing tools, despite the newness of the platforms, despite security questions we may have about the platforms, despite whatever, we've got to go there. And the reason for that, this is to go back to the business technology slide for a moment, just alluding back to that, is the priority for application development is really with customer-facing applications. We want to grab those business opportunities. And I know this is very hard to see. This graph, you'll see it better when you get the slides after the event, but the shaded part up at the very top is saying, among all the different other kinds of mobile applications one might build, by a big margin, the most important ones that people are building are customer-facing applications. That's where the work is. And if you've got to go where the customers are, you've got to go where the platforms are that they're using, you've got to give them what they want. And that isn't helping to increase the pace of change that much faster. And it's increasing complexity, too. Complexity is a word I'll be using a lot today. Complexity, is multiplying along with all these new platforms, all these new applications, et cetera. But the old systems don't go away. Just as we can't say we have a choice about which mobile device we'll support, we're also not able to say, let's just forget about all those boring old systems that we had. If the exciting stuff is in the world of what Geoffrey Moore has called systems of engagement. When I'm talking about the customer-facing applications, those are really systems of engagement. Real-time, the kinds of things that really kind of get people's blood flowing, not the old stodgy ERP systems of the past, but you need both of those. And people are still investing in the systems of record, because not only do you need to create a vehicle for engagement with customers, a vehicle of engagement with partners, but you also need to be able to be as efficient as possible as an organization to make that engagement work. So even though these are two very different domains of software development and delivery, you got to support them both. So more complexity, sorry, it's not avoidable. And then there's the cloud. On top of everything else, we've got this brand new way of deploying software that's changing the way people are planning out their architectures, changing the expectations of customers, changing all sorts of things. I could give you 100 slides from Forrester about the cloud, because that's another topic that we wind up talking a great deal about, but I won't. But just enough to say that we all know the cloud is really, really important. And even though we've been, you know, madly trying to keep up with these technologies, even though we've been throwing out all these customer-facing applications, we've been trying to do our best as software professionals, there is still this persistent gap between business and IT. That, say, within an organization, the IT people still look at the business people and say, can't you people make up your minds? Come on. You know, do you really know what you want? And the business people are saying, these IT people really don't get us. You know, they throw out technology, and it still feels like it's not what we wanted or even what we explicitly asked for. So there, too, is a challenge that people are still wrestling with on top of all the new ways one tries to address this business IT gap through new platforms, new devices, new apps, new everything. So given that pace of change, given that kind of complexity, doing the equivalent of the million monkeys hammering away on a million typewriters, that's not acceptable. We do need to manage software development and delivery somehow. The question is how. In kind of the traditional way we've been doing ALM, you know, we pretty much followed, as I was saying earlier, a predictable path. And that was, we looked at something like complexity as a problem, and we said, well, we need management. You know, the management not just in terms of management tools, but also management people. You know, our development organizations are getting bigger and bigger. We're often offshoring some of our development capabilities. Therefore, we need to have management on top of things. We also need specialization. Nobody can be good at everything. Nobody can know everything. So we need to have testers and developers and project managers and business analysts and so forth. And even within those roles, we need to have sub-specializations. So when I was a VP of product management before coming to Forrester, I spent a great deal of time writing up carefully worded job descriptions of what is the difference between a technical product manager and a product manager and a product marketing manager and so forth. And because managers can't be everywhere, we also need process. You know, process is our Bible. It will tell us whether we're moving in the right direction or not. So process, 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 whether it's seen as management by remote control or the set of principles by which we decide whether or not we're moving in the right direction. We're not merely the million monkeys hammering on the million typewriters. We're doing something a lot smarter than that. We need process. But that created its own set of complexities, right? This itself is a complex picture, which creates its own problems. And they're problems that are somewhat familiar because we've seen them before in other industries. We've seen them really when people have tried to apply an industrialization model to some kind of business activity. And we've seen its flaws. You know, we first of all have seen efforts to get people to be individually more efficient, you know, to do time and motion studies, the most horrible thing imaginable. Just, you know, let's figure out for the average worker what's the exact set of movements or what's the exact set of steps in a task they need to do in order to complete the task properly, and then let's make sure everybody follows that. That's, you know, a very, very narrow and largely ineffective way of looking at how to get people to be productive. And it's also often informed by very ineffective and inaccurate measures of productivity, such as just looking at developers as spewers of code, and the more code they spew, the more productive they are. Well, I think we've arrived at a point where we've decided, or at least most of us have decided, that's not a good measure of productivity. We've also seen the assembly line as a model. And, you know, the assembly line in software development is, well, we've got these phases, and there are these stage gate decisions that we have to make, and we have to keep this assembly line rolling forward through all these different phases. The problem there is that's a brittle system. That the moment any part of the assembly line breaks down, the whole thing breaks down. And people have tried to keep the assembly line moving in software development in a variety of ways. One way I'll call out is sometimes you'll see people with a real fetish for workflow, that they'll use business process modeling tools or some other kind of workflow mechanism to say, okay, if only we could describe exactly what people should be doing, then by God, you know, if it's more than just like one person, if it's a bunch of people, we'll still know when in this task, you know, something gets passed from person A to person B, it'll work. That just pass it along, pass the baton, pass the code, whatever. Do that, and the assembly line will keep running. And of course, if you can automate some of that, that's supposedly even better, right? I mean, but even if you have robots in a factory that are welding parts onto a car, bolting doors onto a car, it doesn't mean necessarily that the overall process is any less brittle than what I just described. It still can break down. It means a little piece of it may be more efficient because it's automated. But it doesn't mean that the overall process, the overall work needed to deliver quality software to somebody is going to work better. And I think, you know, kind of the software equivalent of this is where people sometimes conflate ADM with ALM. Now, ADM, a set of tools often providing fantastic automation to make developers and testers and other people in the core development team more productive, you know, is not necessarily going to help manage the entire process. So whether it's, you know, certain tasks get automatically generated if there's a defect created, or you know, there's, you know, a nightly build script that runs and so forth. That's all great. That's automation is critical. I'll talk a lot about automation later too in glowing terms. But it's not a solution for the overall management problem. Nor is kind of industrialization light checklists. You know, well, if we don't necessarily think that the assembly line can be automated or run the way that we expect, at least we can take this very complex set of processes, come up with some kind of checklist, and then just make sure people check items off as they go, that they don't miss important steps, they don't miss important deliverables. And in the software world, I think where we've seen that largely not succeed is with CMMI. And other kinds of extremely complex checklists. You know, basic rule of thumb: you do not defeat complexity with complexity. And I think that CMMI demonstrated that. That sure, you can have all the checklists you want, but that's not a barrier necessarily against the outcome being something that the user doesn't want. Or it's not a barrier necessarily against problems that if there is, you know, more than one group involved in the process of software and delivery, and there always is, that those groups aren't working together very well. So we're left with a lot of questions, and I think that this period of uncertainty in application lifecycle management has been great because it's brought up fundamental questions. You know, Sam and I were talking just before this, and we were saying that, you know, one of the, you know, kind of the analyst to vendor conversations we had recently was nice because we got into all these big questions. Well, I think that's kind of characteristic of where we are with ALM. We have these big interesting questions now. We needed to go back to some basics and understand really what it is we were trying to achieve and how we know we've achieved it. But we, you know, kind of know that we need to move away from the industrialization model. And there are three things I want to call out that really demonstrate that the industrialization model failed. Number one, it described the work of software and development and delivery in exactly the wrong way. It depicted that work in terms that don't fit what we're really doing when we're building and delivering software. Second of all, it missed the timeline, the real timeline that matters. You know, that the assembly line was maybe too short. That, you know, given the, you know, kind of the strains of trying to get the assembly line built and running, the idea of extending it further seemed a little dangerous. But in reality, it is a lot bigger than sometimes we've depicted it. And the outcome of the work is what the ultimate test is, right? Did we deliver something that the user valued? Are we grabbing those business opportunities? Are we making our customers happy, whether they're internal customers or external customers? All the efficiency techniques that one might apply in the world may do nothing to make sure that at the end of all of that, the customer is happy. So we've had to really look at the process of management as being more than just, you know, keeping the assembly line running, but really looking at whether the output was something that was of value. So I'll talk about all three of those, and I'll talk about all three of them connected to big developments in software development and delivery. So I'll go to the first one, the nature of work and where the industrialization model failed. The work of software development and delivery is not algorithmic. And by that, that comes from a colleague of mine, Jeffrey Hammond. The difference between algorithmic and heuristic work, algorithmic work, there's a formula. You apply the formula. It's like the Taylorite view of time and motion studies. You just do this set of steps, and then you will get the desired result. That's really not software development, right? We all know that. We all know that it is a journey into the unknown in which there are a lot of multiple paths we might take to arrive at what it is we're trying to build and deliver. But there's a lot of room for creativity. There's a lot of room for serendipity, you know, these moments when people working together come up with something that none of them individually would have come up with on their own. And so, therefore, what we're not really looking at is a set of people standing on an assembly line doing separate tasks. What we're looking at in the world of software development is something more like a band. And the chemistry of the people in the band, the capabilities of the people in the band, those serendipitous moments when you come up with creative solutions to things, that's the sort of picture that better describes the work and certainly does not fit the industrialization model one bit. Meanwhile, we've seen this surge of interest in Agile. So I said we write about Agile. We've been doing surveys about Agile adoption now for a couple of years at least. And we've seen, starting in 2009, just a huge uptake in Agile. That was where things suddenly spiked. During, by the way, very bad economic times. I find that really significant. So much so that we can definitely say that Agile is in the mainstream. If a third or more of teams are doing something they're calling Agile, that's pretty mainstream, including more mainstream than, I would say, some pillars of the software methodology community that we've talked about in the past, which have lower rates of adoption than Agile does today. And that's not a coincidence, given what I said about the failures of the industrialization model to really capture the heuristic nature of software development work. Really, Agile started with the assumption of heuristic work. Right? There was a lot of unknown in software development. We needed to come up with a methodology that allowed people to deal with those unknowns. In fact, at the Agile conference this year in Salt Lake City, which was the 10th anniversary of the signing of the Agile Manifesto, the people who signed that manifesto said, one of the competing names for Agile was adaptable or adaptive software development, not Agile software development. That really one of the key benefits they saw was the ability to adapt to the unknown, make corrections, experiment, see what failed, see what worked, and so forth, follow that heuristic model. And kind of the model was pretty simple. Rather than, again, trying to attack everything all at once, all that complexity, with a huge checklist or some other mechanism, they said, let's take a fundamental part of software development, the iteration. Let's restructure that iteration. Let's change the way that we think about what we're doing within that space of time. Let's change the way how we do it. And Agile, especially Scrum, did it in a way that was very customizable, allowed people to kind of tinker with it a little bit to fit their organization. Encouraged people to focus on delivery and the definition of done and handing off working software, et cetera, not merely just kind of creating a Ford Pinto and passing it down the line, in software terms, something that didn't quite work. Make sure that it does work, that it doesn't blow up before you deliver it. So very simple change that had a lot of ripple effects, obviously. In fact, every time I go to an Agile conference, there's a new set of topics around the ripple effects of Agile on things like UX, which there'll be a talk about later, or the change of Agile, how Agile has changed the handoff to operations, which we'll talk about here in a moment. And it's an approach that, as it turns out, has really done a great job of unleashing people's potential. As I said, you jam people into the assembly line or you do these time and motion studies, and what you've done is you've erased the ability of people to excel. As we've learned from research into how software developers work. We've seen that the difference between a mediocre developer and a fantastic developer is an order of magnitude of productivity. And here, I'm using function points as the measure of productivity, but wouldn't necessarily, say that that's the only one. Or that's the one I would recommend wholeheartedly. But we got to have something here. But if we do the math and we look at the difference between somebody we pay $40,000 to and is, doing an okay job, and somebody we pay $200,000 to and is doing a fantastic job, of order of magnitude better job, we're getting more out of our investment. Which has a lot to say about why I get a lot of questions these days about about how teams should be structured and how we should hire developers and so forth. But this could not happen on the assembly line. This could only happen with a methodology like Agile, where you allow people to kind of explore, experiment, figure things out for themselves, work as a band, not as a set of assembly line workers. And people genuinely who have adopted Agile have recognized that these mid-course corrections are important. Agile has a lot more benefits than just velocity. And for a long time, velocity is really what dominated the conversation about Agile. It's about speed, speed, speed. Speed is good, but speed to a short iteration allows you to make a mid-course correction. You learn something, you change something. It's not merely about blazing your way through the backlog. It's about giving yourself the opportunity to put things back into the backlog once you've learned something, which will be another topic in a later session here at this event. But let me caution for everybody here for a moment. When I say Agile, what I'm talking about is something that is not pure Agile. Most people, when they adopt Agile, are not doing what, if you bought a book and you looked at all the Agile practices, they're not doing all of those practices, and they're not doing exclusively Agile practices. They're also mixing Agile with other things. So having said that, if there are any people who are really bothered about that, okay, take a deep breath. It's okay. Because really the norm now is a mix of waterfall and scrum. Water scrumfall, as my colleague Dave West called it, that people don't just do a series of sprints off into infinity. Right? There are beginnings and endings to projects, to product releases. There are moments when you have to go through an audit that halt the development process and you have to demonstrate compliance. There are lots of reasons why we have to have sometimes a beginning and an end. The water part being the beginning, where there's the planning and some requirements work, the end where there is the delivery and some important testing that may happen prior to that delivery. And then in between, sandwiched in between those two water and fall parts, is genuine Agile, a series of sprints. Look exactly often like what we expect to see. But that's the real norm, not the sprints off into infinity, which scares people sometimes because that means there's a roadmap that they have to come up with on their own, how they're going to figure out which Agile practices to adopt first, how they're going to mix Agile and waterfall in this way and somehow not pollute Agile to the point where it dies. So how do we know we've done Agile right? How do we know if we're moving in the right direction? That's where Lean has been really good, and where Lean has been introduced not just into kind of cocktail party conversations about software development, but people are genuinely embracing Lean at a pretty crisp rate, because it provides some guide rails. It tells you whether you're going in the wrong direction or not. It keeps you on the path. Has a set of principles about flow of work, about the prevention of waste, about continuous improvement that allow people to step back from their daily work as agilists and say, yeah, we're doing things right or wrong. There is a set of principles for retrospection then that mesh nicely with the Agile philosophy itself. So we're at a point, too, where people often say Agile and Lean in practically the same breath. So, as I said, mentioned before, we went through this big spike in Agile adoption in 2009. I see more Kanban boards today than I've seen in all the years previous. And so clearly some aspects of Lean not just lean thinking, but some practices that have been inspired by lean are increasingly important. And increasingly important in an interesting way here, that where we often see Kanban taking hold is in the transition from work being done in one group to work being done in another group. That handoff process, you know, that we've talked about before, didn't work too well on the assembly line. People are looking at Kanban as a better way of doing that sort of cross-group collaboration in software development and delivery. Because it's not just developers, right? We've got a lot of other people involved before we're actually finished. So that's a good segue then to talk about what the real timeline of software development is. When we are building something and delivering it, what is the real timeline? Well, it's not done until it's delivered. I mean, that's the basic principle, right? We used to have kind of the golden master copy mindset in development teams, that we got to the point where we did the final build, it was all tested, ready, our work was done. We were not at all concerned about what happened next. That was somebody else's job. We threw it over to the wall to them. And throwing it over to the wall was not a fast process, first of all. This is a pretty scary statistic right here. This is one slide alone that should shock people and has into thinking that there is some work to be done in the delivery process, that there's a lot of waste there, there's a lot of potential mismanagement there, that if I do make a one-line change and the average time it takes for that one-line change to go live is a week, that's not good. It's not good for a whole heck of a lot of reasons. But it's perfectly understandable given how we have been thinking about delivery as just throwing things over the wall to the people involved in release management and operations and so forth, who naturally have questions, right? They're involved in the avoidance of risk and catastrophe. Yeah. System goes live with that one line change. System goes down. Fingers get pointed. Bad things happen to good people. So very often then people will be in the mindset not of saying, hooray, now the development team can be agile and deliver things at this incredibly fast clip. They're saying, oh dear God, here it comes. Because they get the software from somebody else, they look at the configuration scripts that the development team wrote, they laugh at them and write their own. They wonder whether the testing environment at all resembled the real deployment environment. So there are reasons to be cautious. It's an understandable barrier that has to be crossed here. There are other problems in crossing that barrier. Legacy systems have made it very people very mindful about when you do deploy something new, do all the necessary steps to test it before it goes live. Extra work needs to be done above and beyond coming up with that golden master copy. We've seen kind of people assume that the release process has to be like a bus, that the bus is going to roll by at a particular time. You jam as much as you can on the bus, and then it moves on to the delivery phase. So therefore, you can kind of clump things in a way that the delivery people aren't constantly chasing their tails with all kinds of deliveries every, several deliveries a day. Every release has a lot of overhead involved in it. And again, people involved in the delivery part are concerned naturally about risks. And they come from two different cultures, developers and operations people. But we can't really live with this model anymore, right? If we really want to chase after business opportunities as nimbly as I described at the beginning of this presentation, we can't wait that long for people to be able to use software that's already been coded. We have other reasons, too. We've seen Agile, again, speed up the iterations, which begs the question, why are we speeding it up if we can't deliver it? There are often security issues where you can't wait for someone to deal with a security vulnerability. There are compliance issues where you can't wait for someone to satisfy some auditing authority. The fix has to go in now in the live system. It's not enough to say, well, we coded it, and in a few weeks it'll go live, but in the meantime, all our customers are potentially vulnerable. That's not acceptable. So we've got to get past the problems with delivery, which then, you know, has, you know, quite rightly made, you know, the aspiration of a lot of people the mastery of continuous delivery. It doesn't have to be continuous delivery in the sense that we are always indeed delivering, but we are always indeed capable of delivering. If we wanted to deliver every single day, we could. We don't necessarily need to, but we've got the capacity to do that. We don't have to wait a week for a one-line change to go in. And I'll leave it up to greater minds than mine, like Jez Humble, talking at the end of the conference here to say more about continuous delivery. But it is something that you know, our clients at Forrester are very, very interested in, as they are in DevOps. You know, above and beyond just continuous delivery, coming up with a strategy, a commitment, a crusade, or whatever you want to call DevOps these days, to bringing the two worlds, the two cultures of dev and operations into greater alignment with one another, to really making them see that they all are part of the same process, that they're looking at the same indicators, whether, you know, and here's where tools play a critical role, that, you know, we automate steps, we have, you know, dashboards and other things that both sides are looking at. We kind of are always looking at the same process, and therefore the cultural barriers will erode over time, and people will really see that they have a common goal as dev and ops people. What does this mean in terms of application lifecycle management? It means we've stretched the definition. It is no longer just everything up to the point where we have the golden master copy. It is now, you know, really, you know, everybody, again, talking about tools for a moment, everybody that we talk to who are in the tool space have felt this tug themselves from their customers and are doing something around delivery that they weren't before as ALM tools vendors. A lot of it is about automation. You know, a lot of it is to get to the point where you can check in code and then in the shortest possible interval have that code be live. That means automating a lot of things in between. That's where automation can be a very good thing. It means that, you know, there's has to be a lot more traceability in what happens between the point of finishing the code and the point at which the code is deployed. Let me tell you, in this job, been in this job now for a couple of years, I've had more appreciation for traceability than I ever had in my life. You know, I have to make a confession, I kind of personally rolled my eyes around the issues of traceability, but boy, I've seen so many terrible things happen when there isn't traceability, and now we're kind of extending traceability beyond what we thought traceability was into the delivery phase. So from an ALM perspective, it means ALM is bigger. It means now that there are more people involved, there are more tasks involved, there's more that happens at the end that ALM is supposed to cover, whether it's ALM as a strategy or ALM as a toolkit. Okay, the last area where people have moved away from the industrialization model, and that is, what's the result? Again, there's no point in doing all of this, really. Well, there's some point. But there's no point, really, ultimately, in doing all of this if you don't produce a quality product, something of value. Right? That's supposedly what all the management is supposed to succeed in doing, not merely keep the assembly line running and produce a lot more Ford Pintos. Now, value is a slippery concept. I'll say that right out. First thing I wrote when I was at Forrester was, I was writing it for vendors. I was writing it for software vendors, and I said we're moving from product development to value development. Right? We want to be, you know, products are a component of value, but they're not the only component of value. So when I do business with a vendor, I'm looking at not just is this a good tool, but is this company going to be in business? If I'm going to need any kind of services, do they have service offerings that are affordable and helpful? Are there adjacent products that I might be interested in that they have, or that a partner might have, or how well do they integrate with open source tools? I have a lot of questions about that product, but also about the value of doing business with that company. And when I wrote that, you know, I honestly, you know, could not come up with, you know, a magic formula for measuring value. I had some stab at it, but I think we're still working out exactly how best to measure value. But forget value for a moment. If that's blowing your mind too much, let's talk about quality. What is quality? Well, let me do something I told when I was teaching at the university level, I told my students never to do, and that is look at the Merriam-Webster's dictionary definition of something. Don't ever do that if you take any college classes in the future. If a professor is any good, they'll hate you for it, because here's why exactly. The dictionary tells you something that is not useful for a specific application, is not good for a technical audience in a particular area. Degree of excellence. Well, that helps me understand what a quality piece of software is. All right? I might also quote somebody in saying that there is, you know, quality is when you see, when somebody sees value in it. Okay, that's a little bit closer, but I need something a bit more specific than that. I might take the, you know, kind of very altruistic view or the very world shattering view of it's, you know, if you change things for the better, then you have something of quality. While all of these are great and they're inspirational, they're not specific. Right? We need to be specific about the way that we measure quality, because that's what we're being judged on. Everybody in the process is being judged on quality in some way. And, you know, if you ask the management, you know, in that picture at the beginning of the presentation, what they're looking for, well, they're saying, well, of course, we want quality of the product, but we also want, you know, quality code writing, we want quality testing, we want quality delivery, we want quality, all throughout the entire process. Quality is, however, a little bit tricky because we have very demanding people. As I said at the beginning, the customers are demanding. They're savvy about technology. They know what they like and they don't like, and they're not very patient. They're not going to let you drop things in their lap and leave it for you to figure out whether it's going to be helpful to them or not. It's also, you know, it's also tricky because people want things right away. People want, in your organization, you to deliver things as fast as you can. The customers want to get things as fast as they can. Fast. You know, all these different goods, you know, you look at what people are looking for when they say quality plus fast, and you say, well, holy crap, is it possible to be a quality product at all at the end of that, if you're trying to meet all these, you know, all these particular requirements? Well, yes, and let's step back for a moment and first, you know, kind of notice something about the ALM world. Where is it that we define value? Where is the one place in the development process where somebody has written down, this is what the customer wants, this is why they want it, this is what use they're going to be putting it to, and this is how it's going to help them? Where's the one place, presumably, where some initial guidance exists about quality? You know, how, you know, if you push a button, how long should you wait until an action happens? Those kinds of parameters. That's requirements. Requirements are the one place, if nowhere else, where somebody has written that down. Now, requirements have gone through a quiet revolution as profound as everything else I've described around continuous delivery, around agile. It's just been very quiet. But it's significant enough that, you know, kind of measured in terms that, you know, matter for Forrester Research and its clients, I'm both doing the application lifecycle management wave with Dave West, and I'm also doing the requirements wave, our vendor comparison. I'm doing the research with Margo Visitation. So, and these are pretty heavyweight, you know, bits of research. I mean, it's the kind of the hardest research that we do. There's a ton of research, primary research that has to go into it, and they write up the results, and the vendors we're describing get mad at us because they don't agree with something that we've written about them, and wackiness ensues. Anyway. But the reason why we have this separate requirements emphasis in doing the waves this year, and the reason why myself and other people have been writing about requirements a lot, is that people have recognized requirements are where a lot of evil starts. You know, I was working with a client recently where their chief problem was their requirements process broke down almost at the very beginning. They were very template driven, but people ignored the templates. And then, you know, nobody knew where to find all the requirements documents. So several steps into software development and delivery later, there was a tester who wanted to find out what sort of test cases seemed reasonable, but that person couldn't figure out where the initial requirements were. So requirements wind up, if done badly, creating a lot of problems. But on the good side, they also are a place where you can find a lot of useful information about value and quality that can guide the overall process in which you can judge whether application lifecycle management has succeeded or not. We see, by the way, that how much things are changing in the requirements world, measured by just this ballooning interest in requirements definition. Requirements used to mean requirements management. No, not anymore. The definition side is what's getting most of the action these days. A lot of new vendors in this space. Clearly, there's a bunch of bigger market for help with requirements because people are feeling the need to do them better. Every time I try to count the number of requirements vendors out there, the number has gone up. There are new kinds of requirements tools. There are things like visualization tools like Balsamiq or iRise that didn't exist 10 years ago, but now seem pretty mainstream, that people, you know, think that, yes, indeed, you should visualize to somebody what it is you're going to build before you build it for them. And integration with ALM is really, really important. You can't have a requirements tool sitting over here that generates a lot of interesting content, but then that doesn't get passed along to the testers. That isn't the basis of traceability of what gets built and how it gets tested and how it gets delivered and what it looks like in a live system and so forth. It's not acceptable for the world of requirements in its own little revolution to wind up on an island separate from everything else. I think you see a picture here then of why this quiet revolution happened, what shape it's taken, why it's so important for the definition of quality and value. Now, it doesn't mean that you have to be fancy. Does anybody not know In-N-Out Burgers? Okay. In-N-Out Burgers is a chain that really has the simplest menu of any fast food restaurant. There are like three different kinds of hamburgers. You know, there's the one with cheese, without cheese, two patties, one patty. They have French fries and they have shakes. That's all they have. But they do them really well, right? If you read Fast Food Nation and you got horrified reading about hamburger in America, you're very interested in grass-fed beef, you can go to a fast food restaurant and get grass-fed beef that forms the basis of the hamburger. They do their job very simply, very well. They're kind of like the iPad of fast food restaurants, right? The iPad took off so fast because people had a device that was very simple to operate. The apps themselves did simple things very well, but that's really what you were looking for. Doing your banking, browsing the web, that's what people really wanted from their devices often, why the tablet devices took off as quickly as they did. So we're not talking about necessarily making life harder for application developers by throwing more requirements at them. Far from it. In many cases, what we're doing is we're cutting down the complexity of what they think they need to build, if you're doing requirements right. Oops, wrong way. What then, you look at the requirements, you understand the customer, you're weighing your options on how to develop something, you wind up, and I'm going to race through this last little bit here, but I think you come up with a definition of quality that points out that quality is way more than just testing. I think that's another aspect of ALM that certainly has changed, that the quality part isn't just code coverage, how good the unit tests, system tests, integration tests were. That's not the sole definition of quality. At the end of the day, what quality is, doing those things right, sure, but it's the balancing of value and risk. And there's a balancing act there, right? You look at those boxes there in the slide and you say, okay, I want to be able to deliver things faster, but that introduces risk, right? The faster we go, the more likely there are that things will go kerplooey in the process of building, testing, delivering. Complexity creates risk, so let's be sure to avoid that, that there may be things that the customer never sees that are nonetheless barriers to quality, things like technical debt that, you know, over time accrue in an obnoxious way so that at some point we're spending more time on dealing with legacy issues than we are providing new value for our customers. So there's this balancing act between the two, between value and risk, and that's what quality is. And that's also a picture, by the way, as you can probably tell, where it's not just the testers. You just said it was not just testing before. It's not just the testers who are responsible for quality, but it's everybody in the development team has some responsibility for quality, some commitment to quality that they have to make, some ripple effect of what they do on the ultimate quality of the product. And that, again, is what ALM has to capture somehow, not just declare victory once all the tests have been run. Obviously, that means we need different measures of quality that go beyond just efficiency. Efficiency isn't the only measure. There are lots of other ones. There are, for example, some that you may not have direct control over in your particular role, but do matter ultimately for the success of what you're building. So this is from a piece that we did on the metrics that matter, and so if it's hard to see there, what I've done is to outline business outcome metrics. Did the software help create a business outcome that you wanted? And user satisfaction metrics are increasingly popular because people understand that these are the ultimate definitions of quality and value, not simply did we do the tests. Okay, so let's wrap up. We've got a couple of minutes here. What does this mean for you? Well, when I was doing this last slide, I realized it almost sounded like I was talking to a teenager. And that was because we're talking about application lifecycle management emerging from its adolescence. So I'm going to give you advice phrased in terms that you would give a teenager, but have profound meaning for application lifecycle management. So first of all, yes, you're smart, but you're not born with all the answers. Nobody is. Not even the smartest people are born with all the answers. So you can't come up with a systematic way of doing software development and delivery that expects you to plan everything right up front, execute perfectly, not worry about the delivery part. So we need things like Agile and Lean to really capture the heuristic nature of the work that we do, to understand that there are unknowns, there's creativity involved, there's experimentation. You're not done until the job is done. Right? If you've ever had a teenager rake a yard or clean their room and so forth, you have to explain to them that it's not done until it's done. So you've got to go past the golden master copy. You've got to include what happens in delivery on ultimately what happens when operations gets the software and it goes live. You're not the center of the universe. You may think you're the center of the universe, but the development team and, you know, related roles, testers and so forth, they're not, you know, they may congratulate themselves on a job well done. They may think that they've been perfectly efficient, they work together great, but if at the end of the day, the measures that matter, user satisfaction, business outcomes, other things, if those ratings are low, you have not succeeded. And that's because you are not the center of the universe. And last of all, you don't do yourself a favor by trying to be a loner. And this is really kind of a comment aimed at people building tools, whether they're commercial or open source. What we see is in talking to our clients is that there is no such thing as a point solution that stands on its own, whether it's a requirements tool or a defect tracking system and so forth. All of these things are integrated with something else. And sadly, vendors, there's no suite level sale. Right? You might buy most of the things that you want from a single vendor, but people still may want to use Hudson along with whatever other ALM tools they want to use. They may want to use some other vendor's requirements tool with all the ALM tools that you provide. So therefore, the killer app these days in application lifecycle management is integration. That allows for flexibility as you build out your application lifecycle management strategy, as you work with the tools that you have and you build out the new tools that you don't have yet. Sorry I didn't leave time for questions. I had a lot to talk about, but I will be here through the whole day. So if you want to stop me in the hall again, I'm very easy to recognize, being the only guy in a tie. So Thank you all for coming. Hope that was useful, and then look forward to talking to you maybe in the rest of the event here today.
Thank you, Thomas.